Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined down the line by Rick Wilson, the renowned Republican political strategist, media consultant and writer. Rick has been called both one of the best political strategists of our times and father of the attack ad. The author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Everything Trump Touches Dies, Rick broke with the Republican Party after the 2016 election, founded the Lincoln Project, which played a key role in stopping Republicans voting for Trump in 2010. Rick's award-winning column with the Daily Beast is a must-read in the political community, and he also writes for the Washington Post and the Spectator. Rick, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your bio says that you enjoy hunting, fishing, flying, and overthrowing governments. Let's cut to the most important of those. How's the fishing going?
Well, you know, this year, I am looking forward to some time off and going to get out of the Gulf of Mexico in the flats, get away from the phone, and get near the fish. So I'm looking forward to it in the next couple of weeks.
You must be elated at the result, but also exhausted, because it has been a grueling few months and years, has it not?
This is a battle that I've been in for 5 years now, and that seems, on the one hand, like just yesterday that Trump came down the golden escalator, but on the other hand, I feel like I've been living in dog years. This has been a journey for me, at least, and for a few of us who were the sort of original gangsters of the Never Trump world. I came out and opposed Donald Trump the minute he came down the escalator. And it's been a long fight. And as I said, you know, it does feel like dog years sometimes. You know, we've had to come to the realization about is quite simple. You know, the fight against Donald Trump himself, we may have been victorious this year, but we may have to go at Donald Trump again in 2024 if he runs again. We were certainly not successful in the defeat of Trumpism, which is a pernicious ideology that we believe he has essentially inspired in this country. And there are 72 million people that came out and voted for him and said, this is okay, this is fine. And you know, they don't really believe any longer in the fundamental principles of Western democracy. They believe in the authoritarian statism that defines Donald Trump. They believe in a variation of the American dream that is not based on equality and opportunity and a robust constitution. They believe in an American dream that is based on anger and that is inflected with a lot of racial animus. And they believe that there is a victory at any costs idealism. That, you know, it's more important to own the libs and destroy the media than it is to stand firm with the values that the conservative and Republican Party in this country once claimed to embrace.
Don't you lose faith in humanity a little bit, given that he got the second strongest mandate of any president in the history of the country at the election just now? I mean, I'm reminded of that Futurama meme where Professor Farnsworth just says, I don't want to live on this planet anymore. I mean, you've very, very succinctly and very eloquently summed up the problem, but how on earth did he persuade 72 million Americans to think that way?
Well, it's the rise of Donald Trump. And look, Trump is sui generis as a candidate and as a individual. But the rise of Donald Trump was paralleled by the fact that there is a unbelievably effective high bore sewage pipe of misinformation, conspiracies, disinformation, inflammatory racial propaganda, and lies pouring into the minds of those 72 million American people every day. And those twin sewer pipes are Fox and Facebook. And Fox News has had a profoundly pernicious effect on the American political psyche. And Facebook has allowed Donald Trump to amplify and people like him and frankly, authoritarians across the world to amplify and to enhance their ability to pull people into a very narrow political band, to pull them into a very narrow political decision space. And so because those things have become so powerful in the minds of many, many American voters, they have an alternate version of reality. They have an alternate version of what's happening in the world, what matters in the world, and what values they should hold. At this point, if Donald Trump comes out and says, we should all be cannibals, And tomorrow, Fox and Facebook begin amplifying the message, we should all be cannibals. You know, at the end of the week, at the average, at the Aldi down the street, you're going to have people selling the long pig. I mean, this is not, you know, this is not, you know, a remote possibility anymore. This is what happens when you build isolated media silos that provide a narrow gauge feed into the brains of millions of people. And I mean this, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but Fox and Facebook are the proximate tools of the American authoritarian state Trump would love to have built. And Facebook across the globe is a not a tool for connection and liberation, but is a tool for oppression and control and propaganda. And I know people, you know, think you can't take on Facebook, but when we looked at why we didn't defeat Trumpism, you know, a big part of it was we didn't wage a battle against them on the place where they live, and that's in Facebook, and that's watching Fox every day. And so those things have, you know, empowered the darkest parts of humanity. And yes, it is a disappointment that my fellow Americans, that 72 million of them, not only have bought into this, but have done so joyfully, have done so without a true externality saying, hey, we've got to abrogate our philosophies and our principles and all of our ideological priors and give up our rights. It's not because we're being invaded by the aliens or Al-Qaeda or anyone else. It's because Donald Trump told them an imaginary threat called Antifa was coming to kill them all, and that Black people were going to move to their suburbs, destroy their home values, and rape them. It's an astounding decline in what we think of as the American standard.
I mean, I was reflecting the other day just on my own about whether people like Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, people like that, actually believe all this stuff. Because, I mean, it sounds naive to suggest that obviously it's just about chasing the clicks and the views and they'll say anything at any cost. But part of me hopes that they do believe what they're saying. Because if they don't, if they're just cynically lying like that, that to poisoning the well of democracy itself just to chase ratings, then we're in some kind of dystopia.
Tucker Carlson believes in nothing. He's a nihilist. He doesn't believe in any of this. He's making this. He's doing this show, this performative thing every night, for the fact because he gets paid $14 million a year to do so. Fox is an agitprop network. The entertainment factor there, the propaganda factor there, those things are ancillary to what Rupert wanted, but it is still a profit-making enterprise, and it's profitable to. It's profitable to deceive many, many millions of Americans. It's profitable to engage in the kind of corrosion that we're seeing. And look, I'm a capitalist. I believe that people should have the right to own media outlets and say what they want. But they've done so without any consequences for a very long time. And look, Rupert Murdoch is the most dangerous immigrant to ever reach America's shores. And because of his formula that Fox was so successful in deploying, you know, we are facing now a crisis in this country of truly historic proportions. It is a danger to the furtherance of, you know, our small d democratic system. One of the things I think it's important to remember, and why we're going to continue our fight at the Lincoln Project, and I'm going to continue my fight individually, is that they only need to win one more election, and there won't be the structures that have existed for 240 plus years in this country, where, you know, look, George Washington, King George III was once asked, will Washington leave office? And someone said to him, no, you know, there's a 2000 year history of power in the world and no leader has ever voluntarily left power. Well, King George said at the time, you know, if Washington does that, he'll be the greatest man in all history. Well, and Washington did that. And so, the idea, you know, Trump wanted to try to extend his power and stay in office, all those things, you know, those are fundamentally corrosive to the way that this country, you know, had a long series of historical norms and values, and a long series of traditions of a peaceful transfer of power.
I mean, the old adage has been, hasn't it, that Trump supporters take him literally but not seriously, and his opponents like you and I take him seriously but not literally. I mean, part of why he's been so effective at this over the last few years is every day I promise myself I won't be shocked and appalled by what he would do, thinking that he'd lost the ability to shock and appall me. And every day of his presidency, he did something where I just thought, that is extraordinary.
You know, Paul, that's certainly one of the things I think that every critic has come to understand, including a lot of elected officials, is that there is no bottom. There's no point that you're going to wake up and say, oh, he's decided to be the better man today. Oh, he's a grown-up now. Oh, he's not going to, you know, do the things that have marked him as somebody without emotional control and someone who is dedicated not to any broader mission, but to his own aggrandizement and his own, you know, ego and things like that. So, I mean, it is certainly, you know, I won't miss that part of this show. Although, you know, we're never going to be rid of him, right? He's going to be around until they upload him into the cloud, and then he will haunt us for a billion years. it's never going to stop. I know, right? I'm thinking, maybe the technology shouldn't go as fast as all that. I'll take the flying car, but not the uploading. There is a degree to which the risk factors inherent in following that philosophy could rapidly lead this country into a space where the democratic principles and small d democratic principles and the small r republic is not preserved. And it's something that, you know, and this is one of the ironies of this whole fight. You know, it turned out it was the cynical political consultant class who were the idealists. It turned out that we were the ones who really loved all the things that a lot of elected officials just walked away from very easily.
Well, like, you know, democracy and accountability and transparency.
Yeah, the little things, the Constitution, the rule of law.
The little things, yeah, I agree. To be honest, one of the things that flabbergasts me the most is just the dereliction of duty from, say, the Senate, you know, when he was impeached.
Of course.
The Senate refused to hear the evidence against him. And then there were senators going on, like Lindsey Graham was going on Meet the Press saying, well, we've not heard any evidence of any wrongdoing. I'm shouting at the TV saying, you literally chose not to hear any evidence. What are you talking about?
Correct. Look, the moral collapse of Lindsey. Yeah, and look, we've all known him since the way back, as we say. I knew him, you know, back when he was McCain's, you know, wingman, McCain's running buddy. There are a lot of people in this country where there's been a moral collapse. A lot of people in this country where there's been an overt set of compromises that they have made to maintain political power. No one rivals Lindsey in that space. No one. He is a moral vacuum sucking in all integrity like a black hole sucks in matter forever to destroy it.
Just sounds like nothing. You don't like him.
Lindsey is smart and a charming guy in person, but he is absolutely, utterly amoral in every way. And he is pernicious in his actions in the last 4 years. I mean, beyond words. And look, there are guys like, you know, Ted Cruz, Fat Wolverine, doesn't bother me. He is what he is. Guys who are smart enough to know better ought to know better, and they ought to do better. Because, you know, knowing if you're doing something wrong should be a sign to you to not keep doing it. You know, hey, I'm touching the hot stove, it hurts. Well, stop touching the hot stove. But they can't, because they live in, they have a combination of hyper opportunism and terror. They are afraid of Trump, but they also fear that he may be on to something with this nationalist populism. He may be on to something with this idea that we're going to abandon what America was and turn it into Trumpistan.
I mean, you were onto him from the very beginning. Your book, Running Against the Devil, warned the Dems that they'd face an almighty battle to force out Trump, and obviously so it proved.
I'm very happy with a lot of the way Running Against the Devil turned out. It had a lot of parts of it that turned out to be exactly on point, and I was very proud of that. There were parts of it I wish the Democrats had listened a little more intently to, because there were things they could have done that would have focused a little more on the Senate. On the Senate races that would have helped them, I think, a bit more than they had, because we came up short in the Senate, obviously, and I would have preferred to have won the Senate. That would have made life a lot easier for all parties. But I learned about Donald Trump when I worked for Giuliani back in the mid '90s in New York City, in the late '90s, and you know, even Giuliani, who is now one of his chief sycophants, treated Trump with utter contempt, thought he was a clown and a joke, and so I sort of had a space on where Trump was coming into this. that maybe a lot of other Republican candidates didn't, because one thing we learned in 2016, and that actually held up in the minds of Republicans, no matter what evidence was presented to them, in 2016, people would go in focus groups and tell us, oh yeah, Donald Trump's the richest man in the world. Donald Trump's the best businessman ever. Donald Trump's the greatest negotiator of all time. Donald Trump can, you know, he owns all of Manhattan. They believed all these things because they saw him on a television show, on a reality TV show for 14 years that told them a series of very pretty lies about who Donald Trump was and what he believed. And because of that, that illusion of Trump, even after 4 years, we weren't able to penetrate it. And the Democrats weren't able to penetrate it without the help of people like Republicans, you know, former Republicans like us, who had already sort of been anthropologists of our own party for many years and who understood the language, the vernacular, the image, the tricks, all those things that were required to communicate with a Republican audience. And that was where, that was part of our space, was making sure those Republicans who had broken away from Trump didn't slip back. And the ones that were indifferent or uncertain about Trump, you know, we were able to pull them either into neutral and to have them not vote or to vote for Joe Biden. So I am, as I like to say, I'm the anthropologist of the most terrible person in the world. I set out to ensure that we didn't have a second term, which I thought would have been fatal for the country. We set out to defeat Trumpism, and we've learned that that is a battle that is not going to end quite yet. You know, it's like a video game where you defeat what you think is the big boss, but there's a big boss out beyond it. You know, we may have killed the big zombie, but there are thousands and thousands of little zombies running around the country right now who hold elected office or who are running for elected office, who will seek to extend and popularize Trumpism because they think it's an effective and a positive political philosophy, which, I mean, as a conservative, I find that to be utterly anathema to anything I, you know, grew up with. But it's the reality we face, and it's a fight that we're happy to stay in, as we say down south, until the last dog dies, because it's too important to the future of this country to allow that philosophy to keep metastasizing and poisoning more of the American, you know, political character.
It reminds me of the very first Rocky film. You know, you've denied Apollo Creed the victory, but inevitably there's going to have to become a rematch because he's going to bounce back and potentially stand again. I was actually going to ask you, you know, you look at someone like Lindsey Graham or Mitch McConnell, and they're just evil. I get that. You know, you look at someone like Ted Cruz, and frankly, it's embarrassing and pathetic. But, you know, you worked for Rudy Giuliani. I hugely admired him, like so many people after 9/11. Sure. I thought, this is the greatest mayor ever. I paid thousands of dollars to hear him speak sort of 10 years ago, and I really admired the man. And now it seems to be sort of a genuine personal tragedy that he seems to have, like, and I don't say this lightly or to demean him or to insult him, but he seems to have lost his marbles in some kind of slavish devotion to Trump, which is, and he seems to believe it.
It's a very painful thing to watch. If you were a former person who is around Rudy or worked for Rudy, you know, the man who turned around New York from some of its darkest days economically in the 90s. And look, Rudy was always an imperfect character by far. You know, the old dichotomy of not all good men are great men and not all great men are good men. Well, Rudy was often a great man, but not always a good man. But the idea that the guy who stood there and at the most vital moment on 9/11, when the world and the country were falling apart, when no one had a voice to say, we're going to get through this day, Rudy stood on that podium and he engaged in one of the greatest moments of leadership in American history. And unfortunately, after a few years of drifting around, basically, and a failed presidential campaign, he was drawn into the world of Trumpism because it promised him things he wanted: attention, more celebrity, financial rewards. My first book was titled Everything Trump Touches Dies. And Rudy is the pure case study of that in the most painful and the most sad way. He is a tragedy. He's a guy who once had a degree of energy and brilliance that was enabled him to run the largest and most complex city government in the world and to do the right things at the right moments and the hard things at the hard moments. But that person is gone, and he has been replaced by something that is very much in the character of the Trump era, And it is a sad, there is a great sadness about it to me, and a great tragedy about it, because he was a man who did once believe in the law, and who did once believe in the Constitution, and who did once believe in the rule of law. And to see him immolate his career with this clownish performance on Donald Trump's behalf is, you know, we often, people often, you know, misapply just the phrase Greek tragedy. This is a tragedy that is unspeakable. You can't wrap your arms around how much he has fallen, not from grace, but from legacy. If Rudy had not done all this with Trump and in the last 4 years, they'd name high schools after the guy when he died. They rename a bridge after the guy when he died. It would be Rudolph Giuliani Airport, in, you know, instead of LaGuardia. He would have been a historic figure in New York and America. But now he is going to be a clownish footnote in an awful circus.
If you look at someone like Mitch McConnell, who's clearly done the deal with the devil, so purely out of pragmatism, he thinks, well, the guy's got elected, he's got the power, so I'll be loyal. I imagine he'll abandon him as soon as Trump power goes. But with
He did it yesterday by declaring Biden had been elected.
He did.
It was the president-elect. And I will tell you, the reaction of the MAGA tribes was instantaneous and vicious. McConnell is a extraordinarily crafty and successful Senate Majority Leader. He is the best Senate Majority Leader since LBJ, who was an astounding master of the powers of the Senate. But right now, McConnell has had to bow to reality, even though the Republican base truly believes that Donald Trump won the election, that he won California, that he won 400 and some odd electoral college votes, and that this is all a lie. And McConnell has people in his caucus who certainly have known from the beginning that Trump lost, certainly have known from the very start, and who could have reduced the tensions in this country, who could have started the process, the post-Trump era, who could have settled down out of their ideological lanes of Trumpism versus reality and stopped this shenanigan that we face for the last, I guess it's now 6 weeks, it feels like a year, of pretending that Donald Trump was still president or was still going to be president. Donald Trump was never going to put his hand on that Bible on January 20th. And even though on election night, because of the way ballots are counted in this country, even though on election night, we had what we called the red mirage, that was a lie. It was a fundamental lie. And that red mirage, we knew very certainly by the morning after election day, that Joe Biden was going to win this campaign. He's going to take this thing home. And the division and the insistence that we weren't going to have a smooth transfer of power made us look like some sort of Graham Greene style third world kleptocracy that is, you know, run by the dear leader. This was not good for America's brand in the world, as they say. This was not the kind of dignified transfer of power. When I worked for President Bush, the elder George H.W. Bush, we were directed very clearly, you will fully and joyfully make sure that Bill Clinton, who has been duly elected the President of the United States, is able to take on the job from day one. When Clinton left office, he made sure George W. Bush had a smooth transfer of power. When George W. Bush left office, he made certain that Barack Obama had all the tools in the toolbox and a smooth transfer of power and was able to pick up the reins. Donald Trump has forbidden his government from truly cooperating with the Biden transition team. And it tells you so much about him that he is such a petty, spiteful loser that he's going to punish everyone for the fact that he lost. And he's happy to punish the country because the Biden administration really needs to come in there and they need to face the biggest challenge America has on its target list today, and that's COVID. They need to be ready from day one to be in there working on vaccine distribution, working on mitigation, working on economic relief for American families and small businesses. But the Trump administration has done everything they can to prevent that. And that's one more example, as if we needed more examples, of the sort of moral vacuum that surrounds Trump. He does not care about anyone or anything except himself. and he's willing to punish the rest of this country because they committed the unforgivable sin, the deep transgression of voting for someone else.
It's like taking the American presidency and making it some kind of mafia family, isn't it? Right down to employing Ivanka and Jared Kushner. I mean, it is like a four-year-long episode of The Sopranos.
I've referred to them as the Trump crime family for a long time now. There's some truly terrible people in their family, but there are some truly terrible people surrounding them in this sort of claque of people who have profited from Trump and Trumpism. He's put a lot of these people into high office. He's given a lot of these people government contracts. He's given a lot of these people tremendous political power. And they have, of course, enriched themselves vastly, the Trump family and their allies. And they have also failed vastly to perform the tasks that people in elected and appointed and government and high government positions should be responsible for doing. I mean, Jared and Ivanka cannot run a Waffle House in this country, given their managerial experience. And yet they were two of the most influential people in government, their salaries paid by the government for the last 4 years, because they were related to him. This is not an administration that looks like an American political administration. It's not an administration, a first family that looks like an American first family. They resemble, there's a North Korea flavor. The Kim Jong-un, Kim Il-sung North Korea flavor to this that is undeniable. And it is truly one of the things about Trump, the affect and the presentation and the showmanship that appealed to a part of America that I almost think is a kind of genetic thing about the strong man in the human character, because he played that role of the giant alpha silverback gorilla to the hilt, and people bought into it for a long time. But fortunately, 306 electoral college votes and 82 million popular votes later, America has managed to dodge a orange bullet, as I like to say. And hopefully we're going to be in a position going forward where there's a real reconciliation with what has happened in the last 4 years, and a focus on how we prevent it from happening again. And a focus on how we put the brakes on this global rescission of small d democratic norms, and how we put the brakes on this global rise of the authoritarian and statist right in places like Hungary and Albania and Brazil and Argentina, and how we face up to the fact that the bad guys have great tools now, like Facebook and propaganda television networks in their own countries that emulate, Fox for Thailand or wherever. And so all of these things, this problem scales globally, unfortunately. While the problem here was a national problem, it is also reflective of a global problem as well. So much for me taking time off to go fish and fly airplanes. It looks like I'm going to be in the democracy business for a few more years.
I've got tons more questions to ask you, actually, and including sort of the genesis of the Lincoln Project and some of the amazing sort of campaigns that you've run. But the first question there that sprang to mind was, what Trump's next move is. I mean, I met Ivanka Trump very briefly in Davos and, exchanged a few pleasantries with her, nothing substantive. Mm-hmm. But I've been very good friends for many years with Anthony Scaramucci, and I had lunch with him day in Davos. Yeah, he's a legend, of course. Known and worked with him for many years.
I love
and he
Anthony.
Was saying, Me too. He's a dear friend. But he was saying to me, actually, that if you want a sociopath, someone that is the most corrupt, most immoral person you've ever met, he said to me that Ivanka is 50 times worse than Donald, that he's not a patch on her sociopathy.
Well, she is moving to Florida, where the hot political rumor is that she is going to run a primary race against Marco Rubio in 2022 for U.S. Senate. If she does that, she will win that primary. And that will be one hell of a campaign. If she chooses to do that, the Trump base will vote for a Trump over anyone else, no matter what. There's no question about that. The Republican Party, 40% of the Republican Party, they are Trump hotties. They would strap on a bomb vest for this guy. There's nothing they will not do for Trump. And if he comes out and says, "I don't like little Marco, vote for my daughter Ivanka," they will do so. There's no question about that. It's not a debatable point in American politics anymore. He controls them in a way that is everything short of, hey, drink the Kool-Aid, we're going up to the asteroid now, or the comet now, to live forever. It is scary and it's crazy, but it's real.
So do you think that Trump is going to run again 4 years from now, or do you think he's just saying that and it's bluster and he'll quietly fade in and launch his TV network?
I think what's going to happen is that he's going to raise several $100 million, which he will use for himself and his family, by claiming he's going to run. I think he will freeze the field because he looks at everyone else who could possibly run in 2024 with contempt. And I don't think at the end of the day, an 80-plus-year-old man is going to run for president. But he needs the adulation. He needs the money. And he hates everyone else who could possibly run. And he wants to clear the decks for either his son or his daughter to run for higher office, or both. So, you know, you may well see Don Jr. run for president in 2024 if Trump himself does not.
I mean, Don Jr. is quite remarkable that he manages somehow to be even more loathsome than his father.
It is hard to imagine someone. He is the apotheosis of skis, as we say in America. He is just a grotesque creature in every way. No one's missing that Donald Trump Jr. Has a host of issues in his personal behavior that would disqualify anyone else running for president in the Republican Party. But I assure you, he will be the front runner. And Vice President Tucker Carlson and President Donald Trump Jr. Just imagine the future. I'd rather live in like the Mad Max radioactive hellscape than that, frankly.
Well, to be honest, I think we're living in that now. I think we need to move into a post Mad Max dystopian landscape.
I'm working on it every day, my friend.
Now, tell us then. I mean, I've been fascinated by the Lincoln Project ever since I became aware of it. Tell us about the genesis of it. You know, the stroke of genius to get, you know, moderate Republicans to actually peel off from Trump, and, you know, the blocking campaign ads. The fact that you did it with such wit as well. I mean, there's a litany of sort of anti-Trump people that use the same, you know, respectable arguments against him, but they never sort of landed a blow. Whereas when I used to sort of walk in Times Square and see your billboards, they were funny, they were witty in a way that was honourable. Mm-hmm. They weren't cheap points, but you used humour to devastating effect to sort of humiliate this man and reveal him to be the person that he is. I mean, that must have taken some skill.
Well, we had a great team of creatives inside the campaign. We had a great team of leaders. So, you know, Steve Schmidt and Reed Galen and Stu Stevens and I would iterate on ideas every day. We spent a lot of time together on the phone before we all moved out to Park City. To the last 3 months, we were in Park City, Utah, where Steve and Reed both live, hunkered down in a COVID pod where we could all interact with each other and not go out and get infected. But our ability to do this was threefold. One, we didn't have a boss. We didn't have a candidate. We didn't have a board of a super PAC telling us, hey, go slow or go fast. We had our combined instincts of almost, you know, 150 years of political experience between us at every level and at every angle. And so we brought in a variety of different flavors and takes. And Steve Schmidt is deeply steeped in American history and politics. He understands the resonances of a lot of these things. He's, you know, he's run two presidential races. Stu Stevens, probably the greatest ad maker who's ever lived. Reed Galen, who is a guy who understands the technology, the nuts and bolts, the demographics, all the things that make a campaign like this possible to operate, to run. Because we were nimble, we scaled very quickly. You know, we went from our initial budget for the campaign was $4 to $5 million for the whole year. Well, we raised 80. We operated in 11 swing states, 13 specific counties in those swing states that were the vital flip counties. We went after an audience where we knew there were emotional things that why they opposed Trump, but they didn't understand it themselves. So we used ads to block a lot of soft Republicans from moving back to him. We used ads we call wedges to drive soft Republicans fully out from him. And we applied this in a way that relied on a strategy on the top end that was very flashy, a lot of viral videos, a lot of things messing with Donald Trump personally, because we all hold the guy in robust contempt. And we are all anthropologists of how terrible he is as a human. And so we went after his psychology
in the things that we knew made him crazy: his money, his health, his weight, his absurdity, his clownishness, all the things that we understood drove him nuts when people pointed them out. And of course, we understood that if you go after Jared and Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric, that it's going to send him around the corner. And it did. So the role we played in shaping the psychological parameters of the race, the narrative parameters of the race, by being in his head every day, is one that we're incredibly proud of. We understand how to mess with people because it's what we did for a living for a long time. No campaign manager has ever before in the history of American politics been fired because someone else ran ads against him. Well, we did, and we got Trump to fire his campaign manager in the middle of the summer. You know, we've got a skill set that's pretty broad, and we're very proud of the fact that we were able to work quickly. We were able to work with an enormous group of creative talent on the ad making side, on the actual production side, and that we were able to go out and raise $80 million, about half of it from major donors and about half of it from individual grassroots donors, and to deploy that in the states it needed to be deployed in with the messages that we needed to deploy from. So we built this agency essentially out of nothing, but the movement element of it, where a lot of our donors became volunteers and supporters, you know, who wanted to go out and make phone calls, wanted to go out and knock on doors if they could with COVID, wanted to go out and be in touch with people so that they had a role to play in this campaign. And they called themselves, we didn't do this, they branded themselves Lincoln voters. So, you know, we built all the sort of apparatus of a political party and deployed it very quickly. And honestly, we're very delighted with where this race came out. But again, there's much more work ahead, Paul, and we're looking forward to, you know, engaging this, you know, at home and abroad in the next couple of years to push back against Trumpism and authoritarianism wherever it pops up its ugly head.
Well, I mean, I had aspirations in the long future to be a kind of demagogue prime minister to fulfill my own personal ambitions to crush my enemies and do evil. But you've kind of put me off, because knowing that there's you and people like you out there, I can't be bothered to have all that sort of humiliation. I think I'm going to turn away from crime and ill behavior.
Well, you know, we're not Batman, but we're close.
Rick, I know you're busy and I know you need to go, but thank you for, you know, making yourself available. I've hugely enjoyed the conversation. I wish you the very best of luck.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. We'll talk to you again soon.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.